Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. The NAMM Foundation is working to assure that all children have the opportunity to learn and grow with music, and that music is part of daily living for everyone. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hello, this is Mary Lurson, Executive Director of the NAMM Foundation and Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations, coming to you with Talking Up Music Education, the NAMM Foundation podcast. And we are here on the Grand Plaza at the 2017 NAMM Show. So thank you for joining us. We're here with a series of very special guests that are joining us here in Anaheim. And one of them is with me today, David Dick, who is the National Executive Director of Young Audiences. David, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to Talking Up Music Education.
Which I love to do.
So. Little did you know you'd come to the NAMM Show and sit in a padded cell for a few brief moments talking, but it's so lovely to have you here. If we have a little noise that bleeds through, we've got a great live music happening on the Grand Plaza stage and all sorts of people visiting the food trucks and streaming into the NAMM Show. So just give you a sense of where we are. Have you been to the show yet, David?
A little bit, not too much.
Yeah. How far did you get into the NAMM Show?
Oh, probably about maybe 25 feet into it.
Yeah.
So that was good.
But, was it hopping as far as?
It was hopping.
Already.
I mean, it was
already.
Great. Yeah, I've learned after a number of years here, you really have to plan the trip. You have to be very purposeful of the route. You have to be purposeful of what you want to do. I think the first year, maybe 2 years, I just wandered because there was so much there, I couldn't quite.
And that's really dangerous.
It is. Right. So imagine it's coming back to the same place on vacation, where then you start to think during the year, oh, this is what I want to see. I'm going to make a careful point of that. And I think it's also important in the NAMM Show that maybe you don't see everything that year. So if you know you're going to come back the next year.
Speaking of that, and this is just a terrible admission as a NAMM staffer, but there's been only a handful of years I've gotten into the arena. I've never gotten near the arena. I think I didn't get to the arena for 5 or 6 years, you know. And this year, because of our schedule for this great podcast and all our wonderful guests, I might have to get up really early to go into the show just experience it. But it's a wonderful gathering. So, David, tell us about Young Audiences and your role there.
Yeah. So I'm the National Executive Director of Young Audiences Arts for Learning, which is a national network of organizations, 30 of them nationwide. And the space that we carve out is this notion of how the arts integrate into all aspects of learning, right? So with that, I think as a former music educator, boy, the incredible importance of teaching music in a school. And that's the place where we really learn that language. But I think our job is how do we apply that language many places into the school day and out of the school day, that may be the portability of students, but it might not be the teacher. So we carry the water, as it were, from place to place, and think about this just connection of the arts and how they really sort of enrich student learning and sort of enrich teaching. But with it, we're multilingual, right? And this is a really important language to have as part of that work.
So you're in 30 cities, is that?
30 locations.
30 so locations. Some of those are rural combinations.
Different combinations, but last year it was impacting about 5 million students, which there are data on average for the 5 million. We're working with those students about 17 times. So really important to look at. We're not sort of just a one-stop effort. And there's phenomenal one-stop opportunities, I think, for exposure and certainly for content. But I think the job we really think about is how do we create context around that content and really think then about the arts again as that language, that resource, that understanding. I think on the other side of wanting to know facts and figures, there's other parts that especially music and the arts open up in terms of, but how do you really feel? How can you back that up?
So we've heard over time, I know there's some wonderfully strong young audiences organizations around the country, Cleveland is one, right? Young Audience is Cleveland. Any others that I don't want you to point out ones that are better than the other, but some have created a larger national presence by their programs that they've modeled and created, right?
Absolutely. And I think the great thing about being part of a network is everyone can benefit from what's done in Cleveland. And with that, in that case, a real strong emphasis on technology and digital arts. Some great programs, in Maryland, in Miami, just started new affiliates in Naples, Florida, and in Arkansas. Rich presence here on the West Coast. But what's interesting is with it, it's not a cookie cutter solution, but it really looks at the needs of communities. And if anything, Mary, wanting to be known more for how we do the work than even the work that we do, right? So it's the respected partner at the table to know that something's missing if you don't have that representation
and
there.
And the essence of it is knitting the professional artists in a community together with the school and education communities? Basically the essence of it? And how you bring not just exposure programs, but really kind of fundamental learning programs into the school, into students' experience. And, maybe the school district actually builds greater arts education opportunities.
You do. And I think if we all know it takes a village, it's thinking about that village. In an ideal sense, in a school, it's about that partnership with the classroom teacher, the certified music educator, and the teaching artist. And knowing that in many ways we all parallel and teach different parts of it. But I think it's providing that complete experience. The NAMM show is also an interesting extension of that, because I think for educators that are here and for teaching artists here, it's a way of expanding that work into other areas. NAMM is a great example here of, just as we listen to the music that's in this room right now, right? That traditional band program, they're not playing that. But boy, there's students listening to that, right? So how do we reach every single child? And we need a lot of people to do that, right? So we really look at our work in partnership and complementing a lot of the work that other people do.
I have to tell you that we interact with dozens and dozens and dozens of professional musicians, in our day-to-day, and certainly through all of our programs. And I've really encouraged many of them to look at their local Young Audience affiliate.
Terrific.
Because, first of all, many of them as artists want to do the work in schools, but need the training themselves. And they need the understanding of, all right, so I'm a great percussionist. I have this desire to reach into a school, even give away my time. But what is the right way to do that? And I think that, I don't know if we've had anyone has landed in a Young Audience affiliate, but it's certainly something that we've advised our artists that we know to consider.
And it's interesting, Mary, for an organization that next year will be 65 years around, there's some very interesting Young Audience stories that are there.
I bet.
And without a doubt, the percussionist that can influence somebody else to be a percussionist, that's a great story. But at the end of the day, I'm really interested in the opportunity we provide. At one point, those students will be members of a community. And when certain assumptions are made about what we can teach or not teach, they become the voice to say how important the arts are, not just in terms of the content, but also in terms of, again, this space of creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship, which is the future of this nation, without a doubt. So where does that tie in? And again, how do we make the experiences transportable into many different areas? But as you know, there's some things that music does very uniquely and very well that would be missing if it wasn't there.
You also, we've known you for many years, and in every capacity, you have been a leader in the field of arts education. In your earlier life as the head of the Metropolitan Opera Guild, where we first came to know each other, in this really important national leadership job. And through it all, you also took up the responsibility to be part of the leadership team to develop the redevelopment and deployment of the National Arts Education Standards. First of all, I think you're a really brave soul to try to bring together the opinions of so many brilliant minds in the field, building on something that happened, I think, 20 years ago. We had the very first standards for arts education. And then kind of a group came together and said, isn't it time? And then you saw it as an opportunity for you to really, step into a leadership role there. So first of all, I guess we could tell the story of the process. Maybe we'll say that for a separate podcast, right? Because
that's a separate series.
How do you get how do you get people to agree is a whole nother skill set. But what do the national art standards stand for? What are they and what do they represent?
Well, you get people to agree on things when you're really centered on what do students need to know and be able to do, right? So if you're really thinking about the outcome of those standards and its impact on students, rather than the inputs of what we teach or how we've always taught it, right? There's a really kind of interesting meeting ground for a lot of people. And with that, really looked at a set of standards that did not talk precisely about how many scales and how many modes and what you need to
not
be
a
able,
list of
a list
to-dos,
of standards, to-dos, right. But talked about these sort of key fundamental experiences and how they move from time that are sequential. So with it, I think one, a set of anchor standards, and there's only 11 of them that talk about these foundational experiences, but also this instrument, as it were, of a series of essential questions and enduring understandings that range from pre-K to the end of high school. So the idea that we always go back to those same understandings and questions and say, where is my student? And especially, I think, in a field where we can't assume that all seventh graders in music are working on a seventh grade level. So where do we take a responsibility to say, on this understanding, this is where they are, and this is where I'm going to take them.
Give us an example of one of those understandings.
Understanding, for instance, looking at a performance opportunity to be able to connect to the music, as it were, to have a full understanding of the musicality and the presentation of that music, right? And so with that, what does that look like in second grade versus what does it look like, in, I don't want to say your senior year of high school, because the high school is divided into three sections, which really looks at the core competency of students at that point. But what's interesting is that 11 anchors were used not just for music, but for visual arts, mm-hmm. for theater, for dance, and for media arts. Right. So imagine a supervisor of an arts program in a school board that comes in and says, these are the 11 anchors for all our arts programs, for all our students, and begins that dialogue.
It's a lot of strength to build curriculum, right?
And with it, then, a lot of interpretation. So I think, if anything, really then looking to the educator to determine how they're going to do that. So free license, I think, in the classroom, really bestowing the professionalism to that person as well. But the thing I'm proud of is, I think, in the 21st century, how do we present those? Young Audiences developed the website and maintains that website.
I know you do.
Yeah, nationalartsstandards.org. And now
it's available to anyone.
Anybody.
It's open source.
Yeah,
right?
And for the 2 million people that have been there, it's available. I mean,
nationalartsstandards.org.
Right.
So if there's an enterprising charter school, if there's an enterprising public school that's reevaluating, a school district that's ramping up its arts education program, maybe a reinstatement, this is a really important baseline of information.
It absolutely is, but then a great feature where somebody can go in and click music and just click creating and just click a series, that you can really define it also as you're ramping up. You can't do everything at once. So how to use those standards actually to inform instruction and inform a public of what you're doing, right?
So then why do the arts need standards, David? This is all about the field of public education, the funding of public education, the expectations in education. Why do we need standards? I know it's a pretty philosophical question.
It's a philosophical question, but
I love your answer,
see what I come up with an answer. Because I think at the end of the day, it is about teaching the skills and methodology of a language, of an experience here. And
we should be able to articulate.
And
right.
Too often
it's up to us to be able to put it out there for
it.
What it is.
And right. For too often it was, well, you'll know it when you see it. It becomes something you like or don't like. But again, if you think of the NAM experience, for a lot of it, very different content, but still rooted in the same fundamentals of, I'm sorry, either it's in tune or it's not in tune.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what the musical form is, to make that happen. So what are those experiences? The other thing that's really critically important, especially I think with the music standards, is too often what we see is performance without a context and understanding behind that. So where do we have a place that students actually compose the work that they are going to perform?
Or they're interpreting, or they're describing.
And the critical feedback of that, and sort of an understanding. So it is about building that, I think there's also something you said about a common experience.
Well, right? And let's face it, too, there's something practical about being able to communicate to school administration and school leadership that this is working within a national norm. And it's really, if you want to build something with quality, you have something then to point to.
That's it. And you have something to point to, but also, how do we actually start talking about this work to parents? How do we make it transparent to the students themselves that rather than in a high school band, you just stop and tell people what to do? Maybe you stop and say, what did you hear?
And how can we improve this?
How can we improve this? And, you know, you bring a whole different place to it. So I think I like them. I think the standards are very informative. But the important thing is that at the end of the day, those standards had feedback from 7,000 arts educators.
Which is a really scary thought. It even could occur.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful that it occurred. Absolutely.
And there's other standards that have been created recently that are much more top-down. Someone decided in a room, this is what we want you to know. The art standards really took that long process of getting everybody involved. But to that, now as states are beginning to adopt or adapt those standards, no one is saying they need to take the full load and just say yes. But if the development of those standards can get you 50% of where you want to be, then don't you want to craft the other 50%? And there are also a number of states now that are looking at their state standards as a complement to a national set of standards and telling their teachers, you find the best resource that's there. And that could be a mix of a lot of different things.
So. I know I was trained many a long time ago as a pedagogue and took all that training very seriously. And when I looked at the national standards, it was just like there was so much air around the standards. You know, that term means a lot to me. You know, when there's air around something, it means that there's a space for me to have a conversation. There's a space for me to have to enter into to ask a question, as opposed to this. There's a choice either A, B, or C, as opposed to there's a lot of intellectual air in the standards.
Yeah, Mary, it's a great point because if you're looking for a document to tell you what to do, that's not it. The standards are not.
And we kind of want to say that about the teaching field too.
Yeah.
It to reach our students today and tomorrow in the future, we have to have a lot of nimbleness in our approach, a lot of creativity.
Well, that's it. And I think then it respects the professionalism that teachers, and certainly my skin in the game here is also for teaching artists. Again, it doesn't matter who the deliverer of instruction is. What is our outcome for students? And shouldn't we all be on the same page and provide a diversity of those experiences to make sure that student succeeds?
So this moved into, this was 3 or 4 years ago that it kind of ramped into public knowledge space. I mean, the final draft became...
About 2 years ago, actually.
Okay, two years ago.
It feels like 10. To your point, I think where you get the four, I think it was 2.5 years of just getting the development going to that place.
So is it taking hold? What's your assessment?
Are you feeling...
Well, you said 2 million visitors to the site.
Yeah.
States are churning it, looking at it. Yeah. Right.
A number of states have made some significant sort of adaptions to it. There's also a number of states that just, this is exactly what we need. They've approved it. Different boards of ed, some of it's a board of ed decision, some of it's a state legislature. Some area are just looking at those 11 anchors and saying, that's what we're adopting, and which allows then for flexibility of the other pieces. But we've got some great partners in this. But again, we're asking, I think, states to take ownership of a document that we're hoping to contribute to. Back to the earlier question was, at one time, there were 37 different states thinking about starting to revamp their art standards. Fortunately, we were all in the room at the same time together when they realized, wouldn't it be easier if we tried to do this all together, right? And so I think there's been some great movement. Also, Young Audiences now is building out state-specific websites, really cloning those national experiences, but customizing to what the state needs, giving it a state sort of look and feel. So again, that there's ownership that's there.
Yeah. Hub and spokes work, right? Based on values and standards, but the flexibility and the freedom and the trust that the field will take what it needs and adapt.
That's it. So I think, the story I heard is in the state of Delaware, when 400 arts educators are writing the State Commissioner of Education saying, we should adopt these standards. That's a pretty easy decision to make, right? So, but in other places where there's some significant changes they want to make to either represent their state history or culture, it's freely there.
No one's... like I said, there's a lot of air around it. You know, it's very... It'd be an exciting, remember when I first, I think I interacted with you on it, if I was teaching now with those standards, it would be a very inspiring space. Much more than in the old, kind of the old days, you know, which was how many minor chords, how many key signatures, how many, the ability to read on the staff. I mean, it was very prescribed, which was okay in, you know, if that's how you chose to teach, but that's not kind of fun after a while.
No. And I think that air then allows you to also then share what these standards are with students, because we all need to know what the expectations are.
One thing, David, that you're helping us, you've helped us here for a couple of years, NAMM Foundation does have a group of nonprofit organizations that we support as grantees. These are music service organizations that are devoted to primarily childhood music making, but in some instances they're focusing on adult music making. And one of our goals with these organizations is to strengthen them as nonprofits. So you've come and helped us with a grantee summit, and we've actually expanded this year to offer some roundtables on nonprofit best practices. Because here at the NAMM Show, we have over 70 nonprofit organizations that we invite to come simply as our partners. We can't fund every organization that wishes they could have some funding from us, but we can at least have them here as a partner, expose them to our NAMM members. We do ask them to, they sign a little agreement, not to solicit funds or product, but to get to know the industry. The industry is very generous to nonprofits. So in your supporting your affiliates in communities around the country, you're running your own nonprofit, you're helping us with this, our nonprofits. What are the most important things some of these nonprofits really need to be paying attention to now?
First off, I've thoroughly enjoyed my time with you and your, you know, your grantees. And certainly your selection of them is a really important ingredient, I think, in terms of their success. Yeah, I think so often not-for-profits are so busy doing, they don't step back sometimes to think about the infrastructures that really need to be in place to make that doing happen. So things like governance, things like interactions with boards, things like, you know, fundraising, things like an understanding of communications and advocacy, really important tools, but it also becomes the platform by which you build other things, right? So part of it is taking care of your knitting, as it were, right?
Right, taking care of your knitting.
Absolutely, but at the same time, there's incredible models of what that looks like that might not be related to the arts at all. So with that, just really thinking about, you know, the whole notion of a not-for-profit is a very interesting just in its concept, right? And with that, a state provides an organization to say, you do something for the good of the community and you do something for the good of the state you reside. So we're going to give you certain privileges to make that.
You get a pass on income tax.
Yeah, you definitely get a pass.
Right? Yep. Yeah.
And as you know, when you end up with those profit-making centers and not-for-profits, people get a little sort of, you know, agitated by it. But, you know, some great examples here, and we'll be talking about, you know, today and tomorrow here at the show, is about fundraising. And what is that careful mix of individuals and institutions and program directed and general support, and but also what that speaks to really at the end of the day is stakeholdership, right? So if you're not thinking about raising money, but thinking about who are the partners you need to bring in to create the work, who happen to bring some money with them, it's a really important piece, right? You know, at the NAMM show, boy, if you're not thinking that people are trying to sell you product, but thinking there are tools and resources here for me to accomplish the work I need to do, it's a whole different perspective. So some of that perspective, it's like being in a museum where all of a sudden you look at the sculpture from a 45-degree angle, then straight on. There is a nuance there. But you know, the interesting part then is how do all those different pieces work together? Because the spirit and energy so often of a not-for-profit is you don't want to and shouldn't be doing the same thing year in, year out. You should be growing. You should be having an influence on your community that you work in. You should be networking, and especially in a day of technology, networking with a lot of people. But what is it that you want to network? What is it that you want to talk about? Where is the connectivity?
I think a lot of what we have tried to do in supporting our grantees and also supporting our nonprofit partners that are here by the establishment of these workshops and roundtables, and we're so grateful that you're helping them, is to, I think when you're in a music service organization and you decide that you're going to have a nonprofit and be an entrepreneur, be a social entrepreneur, right, through music, is that kind of a frenetic state sets in. You all of a sudden really just are just consumed almost by your own creativity and all the things that you want to do and all the things you want to start doing simultaneously, and you're delivering program at the same time as you're raising money and you're starting a website and getting your board on board. And sometime that governance thing is really going to, if you're not paying attention to some of the essentials, and we've really wanted to help our organizations just have an understanding of the essentials.
Absolutely.
And build more carefully for their own care as the entrepreneur, that we have a network for them as entrepreneurs, social music, some social entrepreneurs, and that they really build for the long term, you know, because I think of all the conversations I've had with so many of our, it's really kind of just reinforcing, you really got to get your board to be a supportive agency for what you, you know, what they said they would help you with.
Well, that's it.
And if they're not helping you with what you need them to help you with, then you have to go back and get that working.
Yeah. And you have to articulate what that help is and what the form should be, right? So there's certainly the formula of time, talent, and treasure, right? Without a doubt. But interesting you bring it up. And I think this is about those foundational experiences. I've seen so often these brand new not-for-profits who start up, whose boards really feel they're there to volunteer to do the work. And I'm like, well, that's not really a board responsibility. The board responsibility is to build an infrastructure to get the work done. So, and it may include the operational things, but I'd rather have a board member for a brand new organization help me think about how to start an internship program with a local university, rather than finding some board members that come in the afternoon and help fold envelopes. And, you know, so it's from the beginning, you got to get it right. Right. And without a doubt, and Mary, it's a great example that as you're starting something out, so often your head is just looking down, doing the work. You need a board to help you think strategically. You need a board to remind you about where are we going in 5 years. And that doesn't matter whether you have a staff of one or a staff of 100. It's the same function.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's nothing more wonderful than an enthusiastic board member that has all the ideas, and there's nothing worse than an enthusiastic board member that has all the ideas. You know, and sometimes you just simply have to go through a training process, and sometimes it's just a one-page job description where everybody's on the same page about what is needed.
Absolutely. And but also we're a field that knows something about ensembles, right?
Right.
We're a field that knows sort of how to make assignments as they were. We know it's disastrous when everyone is playing the same part at the same time, right? So absolutely.
Unless it's deliberately unison, but the saxophone player section cannot step on the clarinet section.
Yeah, but we also know how hard it is to play in unison,
yes.
Right?
And
in tune. So we always bring it back to music, Mary.
I know. Thank goodness. Yes. So what's your impressions of the NAMM show this year? And why should more music organizations join us? What's the value of a music? We have this partner program. Actually, we have a reception at 4 o'clock. You're going to come, okay, right?
Yep, yes, I will.
For our nonprofit partners. There's a couple new ones that are here that I've actually made sure that are here. One is working in very, very creative ideas of building affordable senior housing around the arts concepts. Wow. They're actually building theaters on campus. They're building workshops for painting and a completely different approach. You know, so he's going to be here. I'm very excited to see him again through our connection with the National Center for Creative Aging. So it's a chance for us to network, get our NAMM members to meet these organizations. So again, I go back to my question to you. What's exciting about coming back here this year? And what's your impression?
Well, you know, it's been a number of sequential years I've been here. I've really become now to embrace NAMM as probably the greatest gathering of alternative learners on the planet.
Well, that's great. Right? So, can we use it as a tagline? But I don't know if that would help us. Alternative learners. That's good, though.
Point. Non-traditional learners that somebody steered them at the right place at the right time to see, you know, and especially in this age of sort of entrepreneurism and coming up with new and interesting things, right? Yeah. So, and just this interdependence of product with vision and with mission and with skills and methodology. If there's a chicken or an egg here, everyone's got a different role, but it doesn't start neatly at some one place. You don't first learn the language of music and then someone puts a clarinet in your hand. you do it all at the same time. And one thing supports the other. So I think it's just a really important piece. Also, we make these really interesting, at times, these mischaracterizations of what for-profit and what nonprofit is, right? And with it, by definition, the only definition is a for-profit. There are individuals who can earn from that profit, right? If anything, not-for-profits probably look more at the bottom line. They think very differently about investment, right, and all of that. But I think that full partnership opportunity to see those things happen, and again, one of those ideas of sustainability is how do you form partnerships with other entities? And no one is saying it has to be a not-for-profit, but where's the match, right? Where does that all kind of happen? The great thing in NAMM is you can kind of hear in the ambient noise, it's all happening in real time, right? It's there, it's messy, it's loud, it's the real world.
Here right? comes that little thump to the wall again.
It's there. But I think at the end of the day, the common thread is the learner, the student. What are the outcomes that need to happen? And I think for all of us to think about, what is the community that we want to live in? What's the state we want to live in? What is the country we want to live in? And how do we take advantage of every single resource that's there? And again, I think indigenous to this country is the spirit of invention. And NAMM provides the tools, and it's the not-for-profits and the educators that continue to provide the skills and methodologies to use those tools. And Mary, I think that's why the tools continue to change, because again, it's this back and forth. So I think it's an understanding of that. It's a great place to practice in real time. A lot of things happening at once.
And I think the people who want to be involved in that are really comfortable coming here. And basically, it is eight steps of a scale. It's three chord blues. I mean, it's, you know, the binding, you could probably find the one chord that everybody knows how to play.
That's it. And, you know? And we're listening to 1-4-5-1 right now.
Right.
You can find it. If it doesn't go back to one, we all know it.
Right. And the one, and they're playing a form that we all could identify with. They all probably could punch their way out of, what's the difference between a quarter note and a half note?
That's it.
I mean, and they all learned it along the way, and that's why we treasure teachers,
And
that's a big part of what we do. Well, once again, David, you said it perfectly.
The greatest gathering of alternative learners on the planet.
No, but you've said the whole thing once again. I mean, the kind of world we want to live in, what we're really working to achieve, and we're very grateful to be working with you, David. And
I'm
thank you for being here. And for all
you're
contributing again to our NAMM show, and for what we hope you'll continue to contribute. So thank you for being part of Talking at Music Education. I've been delighted to talk to David Dick, the National Executive Director of Young Audiences for Learning, here at the NAMM show from Talking Up Music Education. Thanks for joining us.
The NAMM Foundation would like to thank Vocal Booth for their support in providing a recording booth for these podcasts recorded live at NAMM 2017. Whether you're recording, rehearsing, tracking, mixing, or overdubbing, Vocal Booth has a solution that's right for you. Learn more at vocalbooth.com. Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. NAMM. That's Mary L. NAMM.